Hello, and welcome to Crossroads, where faith and culture meet. I'm Dean Welty, director of the Valley Family Forum, and our usual co-hosts, Dr. John Sloop and Rita Dunaway, are away on assignment. So we're flying solo today, and again, I just welcome you to our listening audience. We have a great program for you with a very special guest who I will introduce for you in just a minute. Our topic today is a controversial one, as you might expect. It is about Christians and politics. Why or why not should Christians be involved in the public square? What difference does it make who gets elected to public office? Why should we care about what laws are passed or not passed? And what about the arguments that we so often hear against Christians being involved in politics? What about the separation of church and state? Shouldn't churches just keep their focus on evangelism and preaching the gospel of salvation? After all, you can't legislate morality anyway. Furthermore, God is sovereign and will appoint who he wants. So what difference does it make whether we vote or not? Wow. It's a packed program, and I can't think of anyone better to answer these questions for us than our guest, Chris Friend, who is Vice President for Public Policy of the Family Foundation in Richmond. I should add that in the interest of full disclosure, I had the privilege of serving on the board of Family Foundation for nearly 10 years. I worked with Chris throughout that time and have enormous respect for his judgment and for his faith and for his engagement in the public square. Chris, welcome to Crossroads, where faith and culture meet.
Dean, happy to be here. It's always great to have a conversation with you and talk about these issues.
Well, thanks, Chris, and again, welcome. And I'd like to start, I think some of our listeners may not be familiar with the Family Foundation. So give us a little background, if you would. When and why was it founded? What are its primary purposes, its core issues, past achievements, and maybe even major disappointments?
Sure. Family Foundation is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year, as a matter of fact. Started in 1985 by an airline pilot from Northern Virginia named Walt Barbie, who was a parent and was very concerned about what his kids were beginning to learn in school, and just started to meet with other like-minded parents around the state, having this small grassroots kind of meetings, and just continued to find people who had the same concerns, and from there grew the organization into an influential group here in Richmond. Our primary focus is the Virginia General Assembly and the state of Virginia. Our mission is to apply biblical worldview and founding principles to politics and culture. We feel very strongly that we as believers and those who have a biblical worldview have every right and have actually a mandate to make sure their voice is heard, to work through the political process, and to do what we can to affirm the values that we know are best for our culture, are best for our country, best for our citizens. And so we do that on a daily basis here in Richmond and try to affect the culture through political action.
Well, Chris, I saw that on your website, A Biblical Worldview and Founding Principles. You've sort of summarized a little bit what that means, but just for contrast, what would be the opposite of someone who holds a biblical worldview and these founding principles that you've referred to?
Well, I don't think we have to look too much further than a lot of folks sitting in office today, looking at our governor, looking at our president, looking at others who are antithetical, we believe, to biblical values of the sanctity of human life and protecting life at every stage, of protecting the sanctity of marriage as God designed it, of protecting religious liberty, the first freedom in our Bill of Rights, a freedom that all other freedoms are based on, that people who believe that we as man have all the answers and should be in charge of everything and not a sovereign God that we need to submit to. And I think one of the issues that we fought for over the years here in Richmond and around the state, and you know about this, is simply allowing for prayer at the beginning of legislative meetings. And the folks that are antithetical to that say that that shouldn't be allowed because of separation of church and state. And our argument and the argument for since the beginning of our nation is elected officials need to remember there's somebody bigger than them. An opening with prayer at those meetings is a reminder that they're not God. And unfortunately, we have an awful lot that have forgotten that.
Well, Chris, it's interesting that you say that because John Sloop has periodically referred to the divide that you've just described. Instead of the Supreme Court being the Supreme Court, they have instead thought of themselves as the Supreme Being.
Yes, the final arbiter of truth and the American way, which is not at all how our system of government was designed. And those are the founding principles we talk about, the fact that there are jurisdictions for government and family and church that are to be separated, and the government ought to stay out of the business of the family and stay out of the business of the church outside, and except for protecting and ensuring that those institutions can thrive and make sure that marriage can thrive, make sure the family can thrive, make sure that religious liberty can thrive. And unfortunately, over the last few decades, the opposite has happened, and the government has encroached on those areas and slowly taken away those strengths of our culture and a founding principles that said there are separation of powers and that the legislature is the one that is answerable to the people and supposed to be the most powerful, and the courts the weakest. And we've completely flipped that around to now where the legislatures in our country, especially state legislatures, are becoming more meaningless every day. When bureaucrats in Washington, D.C. that are unelected and are simply making regulations have more power than our state elected officials, we've lost sight of how our government was designed, and that's exactly where we're at today.
Well, in fact, Chris, as you speak, it just reminds me of how we have strayed from probably the best known phrase in the Declaration of Independence, which is, we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We have substituted government for the Creator. We are endowed by our government with these rights, and rights that they give, they can just as easily take away.
Oh, absolutely. And I'll be honest, Dean, one of the phrases that drives me crazy, and it's oft repeated by conservatives as well, that says, I have a constitutional right to blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
No, I don't have a constitutional right to religious liberty. I have a God-given inalienable right to religious freedom.
Yes.
It's the government's job to secure those rights, not to grant those rights. But again, you know, Dean, a poll, it's done annually. I don't remember the group, but a poll about people's knowledge, Americans' knowledge of the Constitution and First Amendment. And fewer than, I think, 20% of Americans could identify religious freedom as being one of the tenets of the Bill of Rights. So when you're starting out with just ignorance about what is even in the Constitution, that have absolutely no idea what those phrases mean, it's easy for politicians and for governments then to begin to usurp authority and begin to do what we've seen when the overwhelming majority of Americans have absolutely no idea what religious freedom is or means or what its source is.
Well, Chris, I was just thinking about that this morning, just thinking about our conversation, which is this. You mentioned religious freedom. It is not just religious freedom of thought. It is freedom of expression and of action.
Yeah.
And it just reminded me that were it not for that very First Amendment to the Constitution incorporating the religious freedom phrase, the Constitution likely would never have been approved.
Right. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, here in Virginia, where the foundation of even that First Amendment came with a statute for religious freedom penned by Thomas Jefferson, which clearly says that our faith, our beliefs were not to have any kind of government action taken against us because of our beliefs. And that word exercise is so key, because you hear all the time people like the president say you have a freedom to worship.
Yes.
Just ridiculously unconstitutional Supreme Court decision this past summer over the marriage issue, where Anthony Kennedy talked about, well, they'll be able to continue to talk about marriage the way they see it and believe it in their churches. And Justice Alito called him out on it and said, you've basically said that there's this whole group of people that are now going to be second-class citizens and shoved into the churches, and you have and believe what you want, but you're not allowed to bring it out there. And that is not at all what the Constitution says. I have a right to free exercise. That's action. That's participation. It goes way beyond belief. We're not second-class citizens just because we happen to believe in a biblical worldview.
Well, and I think you've put your finger on that word exercise, the free exercise of religion. And it just reminds me that increasingly we are hearing our leaders of the Democratic Party, that includes President Obama and presidential candidate Hillary Clinton, who refer to the freedom of worship as though it is to be restricted to the inside of the churches and not to be taken outside, to the free exercise in every area of our lives. Well, Chris, you've mentioned several core issues that you pursue: life, marriage, religious freedom. There's also parental authority, and I think a reference to the Constitution. I wonder if you could just elaborate on both of those.
Sure. Those are the five areas we at the Family Foundation work in. As you mentioned, life, marriage, and religious liberty. And then we believe parents have the responsibility to raise their kids, and government should allow them to do that without too much interference. That's why we believe in educational freedom, and we want parents to be heavily involved in the education, the upbringing of their kids, and then constitutional government, that despite their flaws and despite their imperfections, the Founding Fathers got it right when they penned our Constitution, and that they recognized that balance between faith and freedom, and the importance of faith and the importance of limited government, and they got it right, and that we need to return to those core values and to that constitutional concept. But, Dean, we've got a lot of work to do when very, very few people even know what's in the Constitution to be able to practice it. And I think that's one of the big failures of the generation that we have, is that they have absolutely no idea what our Constitution actually says and means.
Well, Chris, you've articulated your purposes and your core issues very well, but I know there are some people who might suggest that we are all blow and no show. I wonder if you could talk about some of your past achievements and maybe also your major disappointments.
Well, you know, Dean, the Family Foundation's been here for 30 years, and there's plenty of both.
Sure.
When you're in this business and in this work for as long as this organization has been, I think you're always going to have you're going to have some successes and you're going to have some failures. But I think especially in recent years, in the last decade or so, and certainly credit goes to legislators who led on these issues, and credit goes to a multitude of organizations that participated, and we're glad to work with and to be part of adopting a lot of these things. But you know, all the way back to 2006 and being able to adopt the definition of marriage into our state constitution through the vote of the people was a tremendous victory. In recent years, being able to bring some basic health and safety standards to abortion centers in Virginia, to be able to update our informed consent law with modern technology so women have all the information that they need before making that decision. Some things that maybe people don't know about, you know, we adopted a parental rights law that parents have a fundamental right, which in law is very, very important to have in the code, a fundamental right to raise their kids and to direct the care and upbringing of their children. In religious liberty, we, a few years ago, passed a law to protect the rights of faith-based child placement agencies, faith-based adoption agencies, to be able to adopt kids into families according to their beliefs. They believe that children deserve to have both a mom and a dad, and the state shouldn't force them to go outside of that belief when we were able to pass that law. All the way to things like protecting property rights in our state constitution, something that maybe people aren't, you know, as aware of, that we get as broad as that. But again, it's a constitutional principle to be able to have and to own property without government interference, and something that we were able to do a few years ago. So we've had a lot of really, really great victories over the years, and there's more. There's others that we've done. I think some of the things that school choice, I think having a scholarship tax credit in Virginia now where kids, people can donate to scholarship organizations and kids can get scholarships from them. There's over 1,000 kids now in Virginia, maybe higher than that, maybe closer to 2,000 that are attending private school right now that couldn't before because of the scholarship tax credit, and that's going to continue to grow and multiply. I think that where we would have seen disappointment is, you know, not being able to, as we said, protect prayer at government meetings in our law, although the Supreme Court has upheld those kind of prayers at government meetings. And then seeing things like what we've seen in the last few weeks from the McAuliffe administration attempting to roll back abortion center health and safety standards. And it, despite everything that we're learning about Planned Parenthood with the videos that we've seen out there and just the horrors of what goes on in those places, where all the other states are actually implementing stronger standards and investigating under this governor in Virginia, we're actually going backwards. And the abortion industry has full sway over this governor and absolute total control over him. He will do whatever they ask and say. And that's been unfortunate to see that. But, you know, a lot of people have done a lot of work over a lot of years, from grassroots to donors to many groups to get these things done. And we'll continue to fight those fights and continue to do what God's called us to do.
Well, I know you've listed that as a major disappointment because you worked hard. I saw you in action to get those abortion clinic regs implemented. And really what they are is simply asking abortion clinics to meet the same health, safety, and reporting standards as other similar ambulatory outpatient clinics. Am I right?
Absolutely. And there's so much misinformation out there about, because the media in particular has just refused to be honest about this issue, and they spin things completely incorrectly or inaccurately, and saying, oh, these abortion clinics now have to be like hospitals. Well, in Virginia, there's five or six different types of hospitals. Nursing homes are considered a type of hospital. Outpatient surgery centers are considered a type of hospital. There's several, and all of them have standards that they meet according to the type of treatment that they give. And so abortion centers didn't have to be like hospitals in every way. They had to meet standards that were appropriate for the type of surgery that they do, the type of anesthesia that they do, the type of treatment that they do in those places. And you know, for over 20 years, abortion centers in Virginia were hidden behind a veil of political secrecy. No one knew what was happening in there, and the abortion industry assured us that they were safe and clean. And when we adopted these standards a couple of years ago, for the first time in two decades, public health officials got inside these facilities and inspected them. And Dean, what they found was horrific. And it's remarkable, and it's one of the things that's most frustrating, I think, and I know you can relate to this, is when you know the truth and you see the truth and you can show people the truth, and they completely ignore it or dismiss it. And we actually heard testimony at the last Board of Health meeting where someone from the abortion industry said, before these regulations were passed, everything was fine. After, everything is fine, and nobody has found anything to say otherwise. Over 400 health and safety violations in these abortion centers. Some of them, sure, record keeping and things that maybe aren't a big deal to some. But other things, literally blood on equipment, blood on patient tables, blood on the wall in treatment rooms, unsterilized equipment, improperly sterilized equipment, doctors that didn't wash their hands or change gloves between patients, staff that was untrained that was mixing drugs and helping in the administration of drugs that they have absolutely no business doing, that violate state and federal drug laws. And abortion centers in Virginia, Dean, that blatantly violate DEA requirements of tracking Schedule II narcotics, a type of narcotic, cocaine. Methamphetamine is a Schedule II narcotic. There is anesthesia used in some of these facilities that are Schedule II. Any doctor will tell you. Talk to any nurse that works in a doctor's office. If you don't keep good records, what happens? They will tell you they're going to lose their license. The government's going to come down on them like you wouldn't believe. Abortion centers in Virginia, nothing.
Well, Chris,
they can get away with it and do whatever they want.
Well, Chris, it really makes you wonder whose war on women this is anyway.
Absolutely.
If they are unwilling to protect women and to give them the same health and safety standards as in other clinics that you've referred to, it makes you wonder who is actually responsible for the war on women. One more question about this, Chris, and we'll move on.
Sure.
But how do you account for the fact that our governor and our attorney general are willing to overlook these violations of health and safety standards? I think you mentioned something about follow the money.
Oh, I think it's a combination of it's their belief. They're absolutely 100% committed to the belief that abortion is a good thing and are going to do everything they can to make sure that abortion is not just available and legal, but preferred. And I believe that with my heart.
Yes.
But beyond that, they received over $2 million between them in campaign donations and campaign help in the last elections. And we're now learning what $2 million will get you in Virginia.
Now, the $2 million from whom?
From the abortion industry,
yes.
From Planned Parenthood, from NARAL,
yes.
From these entities,
yes.
That, you know, we see the debate over Planned Parenthood right now, the $500,000,
yes.
Or $500 million, excuse me,
yes.
In taxpayer funding that goes to that organization and what we now know about them. And they bought and paid for what's happening from the McAuliffe administration. And he put two people on the Board of Health, the group that makes the decisions about these, that have direct ties to Planned Parenthood. One used to be on the board of the Virginia League of Planned Parenthood. The conflict of interest is blatant.
Well, Chris, it is horrific. It is disappointing. I know it's a major disappointment, just as I know it was a major disappointment for you to work so hard in 2006 to pass that marriage amendment incorporated in the Virginia Constitution and then have our attorney general and our governor usurp the authority of the General Assembly and of the Virginia voters to redefine marriage through the courts. We've already discussed that in previous programs, so unless you have something to add, I'd like to move on to your report card and just talk a little bit about the political and values divide within the General Assembly. Talk a little bit about the report card and the gap that you find.
Right. Well, every 2 years we do a legislative report card, Family Foundation Action, that lists out about 20 or so votes over 2 years, random votes that are on our issues. We try to be broad-based on that so people can get a good sense of where members, the 140 members of the General Assembly, stand on these issues, and you can look at it. And they're scored from 100 to a zero, depending on how they voted. And there is a clear divide between the two political parties in Virginia. There's absolutely no question about that. And that divide, I think, is going to continue to grow over time, simply because the partisanship is continuing to grow,
Chris,
and getting worse.
Chris, let me be specific for our listeners. You talk about the political divide in your last report card. This is the readout that you discovered. Mm-hmm. In the House of Delegates, the Democrats scored only 20 out of a possible 100. In contrast to that, the Republicans in the House of Delegates scored a 93. So you have in the House of Delegates, Democrats 20, Republicans 93. In the Senate, the divide is even higher. The Democrats in the Senate scored only 14 out of 100, and the Republicans scored 92. Again, 14 to 92. A huge gap between the parties.
On average, and if you look, you can see that since 2009, that those numbers have gotten worse. In 2009, Democrats, it was 32% and 29%, still not great, but certainly higher, down to 20 and 14. And I think that's what you're seeing, this partisanship gap grow. And there have been some folks who have left the legislature that were pro-life or pro-marriage in the Democrat Party that are no longer there. And, Dean, all of this, I think that this is a really key point. And we can be as angry as we want at Terry McAuliffe, and we can be as angry as we want at Mark Herring. We can be as angry as we want at members of the General Assembly. who don't do what we want them to do. But when we look at the elections in 2013 between Terry McAuliffe and Ken Cuccinelli and compare it to the election in 2009 between Bob McDonnell and Creed Deeds, and we look back at the numbers, and what was staggering is that in 2009, more than 70,000 more self-identified evangelicals voted in 2009 than voted in 2013. It's between 70 and 90,000 fewer self-identified evangelicals in 2013. Ken Cuccinelli lost that race by 50,000 votes. The fact of the matter is that if self-identified evangelicals sitting in the pews in Virginia had turned out in the same numbers in 2013 as did in 2009, we would not be having this conversation.
Well, Chris, thank you. That brings me right to the heart of this, and we only have a minute for it. But by some estimates, 50% of evangelical Bible-believing Christians are not registered to vote. And of those who are, only 50% actually vote. That means only 25% of us help select our political leaders. Now here, Chris, in just a minute for each one, you hear these common arguments. Well, you can't legislate morality, number one. Number two, there's a separation of church and state. Number three, politics is dirty business, we shouldn't be involved. Number four, the church needs to stay focused on evangelism and preaching the gospel. And number five, God is sovereign, he'll put the right person in the office. Anyway, go for it, Chris, you've got a minute.
thank God that over history, men like William Wilberforce and Dietrich Bonhoeffer didn't listen to those arguments. That saw that there was evil in their day, and they fought it. And morality is legislated every day, whether you're part of it or not. Somebody's morality is being legislated. We as believers are not second-class citizens. We have the right to be involved in this. And correct me if I'm wrong, Dean, but my Bible says that we're to make disciples of all men. That is our command. And absolutely, being a good citizen is part of being a good disciple.
Well,
anything else, we need to be good citizens.
Well, in addition to that, the first commandment God gave Adam and Eve was to exercise dominion over all the earth. This is a part of the delegation of responsibility that he has given us. Chris, let me just say for our listeners as well, we are so grateful for our Valley legislators. You know them well. You work with them well. But members of the 100 Club, those who scored 100 on your report card, include Senator Obenshain and Delegates Ben Klein, Todd Gilbert, and Steve Landis.
Mm-hmm.
In addition, Delegates Dickie Bell, Rob Bell, and Tony Wilt were right behind at 94. In contrast, you mentioned Democratic Senator Creed Deeds. He scored at the very bottom of your report of both chambers with a 5.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
You've got some super folks out there, and we work closely with all of them, and keep sending them over here.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for your work. We're going to have to bring this to the close. I think we're going to have to get you back to continue to this, but just really, people can go to your website at familyfoundation.org to find out more about what you do and how we can be involved. So thanks, Chris, for being with us. I'm going to have to bring this to a close. And listeners, thank you for being with us as well. I'm Dean Welty. Thanking you again. We welcome your comments, your financial support. You can write to us at Crossroads, P.O. Box 881, Harrisonburg, 22803. And if you weren't able to catch all of this program or would like to recommend it to your friends, it is available on our website at valleyfamilyforum.org. Thanks again, Chris.
Thanks, Dean.
The day that the Lord has made. Come, let us rejoice and be glad in it. Oh, this is the day that the Lord has made. Come, let us rejoice and be glad.